to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime.
What's up, SDS Nation, and welcome to another episode of Surviving the Survivor. We are back, and we are back live, and we're back live for good. Of course, it is the podcast that promises to bring you the very best guests in true crime. And I am not joking when I say you're in for a treat tonight. If you can find a better panel anywhere, you get your money back. You let me know, because I know it is not happening. This will be the best panel you see on this topic tonight, or probably any night for that matter. New York police appear to have cracked a 13-year-old cold case. Accused Long Island serial killer Rex Huerman appeared in court again just this past Tuesday. Huerman has been charged with murder in the deaths of three of the 11 victims whose bodies began piling up on Suffolk County's Gilgo Beach back in 2010. The question must be asked, how many more murders is Rex Huerman, the man accused of these crimes, how many more murders is he responsible for? Best guest joining us tonight, Dr. Ann Burgess, is all you really need to say. She's an internationally recognized pioneer in the assessment and treatment of victims of trauma and abuse, and author of A Killer by Design, which she told me just got translated into Hungarian as I just got back from Budapest. Among her many awards and accolades in 2016, she was named a living legend by the American Academy of Nursing. She's worked with the FBI Academy special agents to study serial offenders, and the super successful Netflix show Mindhunter is loosely based on some of her early work at the FBI. Laura Richards, a new face and one that we will welcome back hopefully many times. She spent a decade analyzing violent crimes at New Scotland Yard, as in the New Scotland Yard. She became the violence advisor to the National Police Chiefs Council. She was trained by world leaders at the Behavioral Analysis Unit, the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime at the FBI in New Scotland Yard. She's applied her psychology degrees to analyze violent crime from a behavioral and preventative perspective. She's an expert in coercive control. We're not talking about the kind my wife uses on me. Slightly different. In 2005, Kerry Rawson, she heard a knock on the door of her apartment. When she opened it, it was an FBI agent informing her that her father had been arrested for murdering 10 people, including two children. It turned out he was a serial killer known as BTK, a name that he had given himself to describe the horrific way he committed his crimes, bind, torturing, and killing them. She didn't wallow in that pain, and instead she picked herself up. She wrote a book called A Serial Killer's Daughter. She's been featured on numerous shows, including Dateline. And last, but certainly not least, Mark Safarik. We had a little confusion. He was going to come on tomorrow night. Better to have him tonight. One of the most respected members of the FBI's elite behavioral analysis unit. And yes, he does know Ann Burgess. He has established himself as an internationally recognized expert in the analysis and interpretation of violent crime behavior. He spent 30 years in law enforcement, even as a beat police cop, 23 years with the FBI, where he spent over half of that time as a criminal profiler. So welcome to one and all. Quick reminder, you can follow us on Facebook, Insta, Twitter. We are at Podcast STS. That's where I put up all the show announcements. You can support us at Patreon. You can become a YouTube member. And look at this from Ski Hat Sarah to start us off. I don't even care what we're talking about. Joel's back. It is awesome to be back. It is weird. Told these guys, I'm super excited for the show. Feel a little rusty. It's like getting back on a bicycle. The trip to Europe was amazing. Plan to do a show about that with Carm. We're trying to figure out a way to do it. It was heavy. We saw where she was hidden during World War II. She took us to the Catholic school where a nun saved her life. And I never knew this fact. We drove back from Budapest, Serbia to Budapest. It was a 4-hour drive through farmland. And Carm, my lovely mom, told me on the ride back that when the war ended and they were liberated, She walked that in the dead of winter with all her belongings, with all her family members. It took 2 weeks in the dead of winter, and had never known that fact. So the things you learn. Without further ado, let's get into the story. It's great to see everyone. We know by now that Rex Huerman is accused of murdering three. He is the prime suspect in the fourth killing. As you know, I always like to remember the victims, the ones that we know. Police say he is responsible for Amber Lynn Costello, 27, Melissa Bartholomew, 24, Megan Waterman, 22. And he is the prime suspect, as I said, in the fourth killing of a woman named Maureen Brainerd Barnes, 25. The victims collectively have become known as the Gilgo Four. Mark, your first time on the show, but certainly not your first time dealing in these matters. What's your bird's eye view of this case, where we stand right now?
Well, I think I remember getting contacted back in 2011 or 2012 on these cases. You know, at that time, we didn't really know anything. And I've always said, like, you've got to know who your victims are. If you have to know the names of the victims. If you don't know who they are, if you've just got skeletonized remains, you've got to be able to figure out who they are and then work backwards from that, find out their connections. I think there's a lot of work that's being done here. Clearly, the burner phones and burner email accounts and the DNA analysis all really strongly points to Rex. There's other cases here, and I think, you know, it's divided whether people want to think that they're attributed to Rex. It really is a kind of a good dumping ground area. So some of those earlier cases where you have dismembered bodies, you know, I can't, no one can say right at this point whether it would be Rex. They're earlier than the Gilgo Four and a couple of the other cases. So sometimes we see offenders will, you know, do a lot, like dismember victims, transport them to different locations to keep police from finding out, you know, or identifying who they are or linking them to a particular area. Sometimes as they get better in the killings, they then, you know, get sloppy. They get careless. They get to a point where they think they're not going to be caught by law enforcement. I know Robert Yates did that, Spokane serial killer. Sometimes they go very distant and then they move closer to where they live just because they become like invincible. So I think right now there's a lot of work being done. Rex traveled. So, you know, you have other agencies looking at the times if there's missing persons. You know, when he was those different locations, Las Vegas, Iceland. So, I think that's where we are. I think there's a very, very strong case with the four they have, although he hasn't been charged with one of them, but it's that case is very strong, Maureen's case. And then the others, it's going to be very difficult, I think.
And Mark mentioned some other cases. We'll get to it later on. Atlantic City authorities have come out and said they don't believe there's a connection because there were some similar killings down in Atlantic City. Laura Richards, typically I always start with the legend Ann Burgess, but these are two new faces to the show. And so Laura, inevitably, I always get emails after every show and they say, you're convicting this guy. He hasn't had his day in court. Mark just intimated that he believes the evidence is pointing in his direction. Do you feel that Rex Huerman is the man behind at least three or four of these murders right now? Oh, you're muted. I'm sorry. That's the problem with muting.
Here we go. I'm back on. Yeah. I was going to say I would have no problem with you jumping in with Dr. Ann Burgess, the legend and Shiro. That would be fine by me. But in response to your question, I would say, well, that is true. He will have his day in court. And we heard his lawyer, Michael Brown, yesterday say we should consider the fact that he could be innocent. And we also have to think about the 32-page bail application where there's a lot, you know, almost a 40-page document that is very detailed. And the task force have done a very good job here for almost a year where they've been piecing together multifaceted evidence. Some is direct evidence and some is circumstantial evidence. But so far, the evidence looks overwhelmingly compelling that it's all pointing in one direction. And that's from not just the burner phones. We have to remember there were 7 burner phones, but one of them was found on his person, which is a very important piece of evidence. But the fictitious names and the emails and the Tinder profiles and the phone calls taunting the victims' families, the fact that he carried a burner phone with his own personal phone and the victim's phone, well, that is very sloppy, quite frankly, but it's very important evidence that's been pieced together, along with DNA. We have hairs, 3 hairs that were from his wife found on 3 different victims, and then his own hair that was linked back to his pizza box, the pizza that he ate. And so that was the last piece of DNA evidence. So I would imagine that we are only seeing some of the evidence at this stage, bearing in mind that a 2,500 page document, I should say, or set of documents and videos was handed over to the defense yesterday, 8 terabytes of information. And this investigation is only really just beginning. And we have to remember all the evidence that's been taken out of the house. There's still a lot more to come from the vault, the soundproofed room. Who has one of those, you know, underground, built to a specification with 297 firearms in it? All of these things, of course, have to be processed. But for me, so far, there is overwhelming and compelling evidence that points in one direction.
And Laura brings up a good point. And tomorrow night, we're going to go deep into the investigation. We've got Cheryl Mack McCollum, a CSI crime scene investigator from the Atlanta PD. She's coming on tomorrow night with Detective Sergeant Chris Anderson of the 1st 48. And we're going to get you a criminal profiler on top of that as well for tomorrow night's show. Gail became a new member. Shout out to Gail, as well as Kitty became a new YouTube member. And the minute, by the way, get a lot of these. We love Carrie Ross, and we're about to get to Carrie. But you know, the minute I heard this story break, I reached out to you. We had you on before I left for my trip, and now we've had a couple of weeks to digest this. What stands out to you, if anything, about Rex Heuermann compared to other, you know, people in this, dubious, unenviable league that he now finds himself in?
Yeah, several things, Stu. One, I always like to see how the victims are targeted, if they're targeted, or whether they're just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. It looks like he clearly did target them using these burner phones. There is also one victim, I understand, that did get away initially, but then not. So something happened in that case of how he was trying to control her. I think that's important. Where they occurred, where the access occurred, how many crimes there were, some possibility that the home might have been used. And just to comment on the home, evidently that is his childhood home. And I'm interested that if they had this shelter, bomb shelter, so to speak, was that there when the parents were there? And how was it used? I just think that that's all very, very interesting. The other important thing, I think, is that he really is he talks about having this double life. Well, he's high social competence is what we would describe. And these are very hard persons to catch, if you will, because they are usually they have a job, they're married, they fit right into the neighborhood or the community in some way. And so people don't think, they're very surprised when it comes out that he's been, that person has been arrested. So we've had a few of those in the serial killers we looked at. There were probably a handful that were as highly socially competent. Certainly the BTK was, and I think Carrie is going to be able to tell us more about that. So that's always a very interesting thing of how they get away with it, not only from the victim standpoint or when they are before they're arrested, but also the family and the community. That he was in a professional community of some kind, being an architect of some nature. Well, those are some of the things that I think are rather interesting to further explore.
Well said. And Carrie, obviously, we have to ask you about Rex Heuermann's family, because no one knows this more than you do. We do know by now that his wife, Asa Ellerup, has filed for divorce. They have children, Christopher Sheridan, 33, who's developmentally disabled from what we understand, and a 26-year-old daughter, Victoria Heuermann. We'll get into the specifics, but from, again, a bird's eye perspective, what must they be dealing with today and in the coming days and weeks?
Can I answer Anne's thing about the bomb shelter? So 100%. We're being told that Rex poured concrete. So New York Post is reporting it's a one floor story home. And I'm hearing reports of a basement, right? You see the cellar where he's going down from outside. But then they're reporting that this shelter, he poured concrete in his backyard, and it looked like he had built a wooden deck over it. And they used ground printing. Somebody else can explain the ground penetrating sonar and radar, but they saw something was under there. So you see these guys moving this deck, and he had poured concrete down there and was like a vault for his guns. There was questions about, was it soundproof or not, and what he was doing in there. And we can, everybody else can address that more, but with the family, good Lord, Joel, is getting complicated. I've been running media. What has it been? 2 weeks? I don't even know. I've lost track of time. Everybody wants to talk to me because I'm one of the only kids of these guys that talks publicly. Mm-hmm. So everybody wants to talk to me and know what my experience was like. And I'm trying to advocate for his family the best I can. She's filed for divorce. Now she's got a lawyer. Now the kids have a lawyer. That just came out yesterday. Lawyers are coming forward. Now it sounds like there might be lawsuits coming forward. I mean, we can talk about evidence collecting in the house and what was left for the family, the pros and cons of that. I mean, they're just dealing with so much. I mean, it's you're managing everything, finances, law, legal stuff. Your house is a mess. You're finding out your dad and your husband is a serial killer. You need trauma therapy. I mean, they're saying the kids can't sleep. And then Asa says she doesn't have a bed. We need to talk about that. I don't exactly know what was left for them or why does she not have a bed? Was it removed for evidence? My family's house was not ransacked, but that's because my dad confessed and then told them where to get the stuff. And no crimes were committed in my father's house. It was just, there's a different element there that's beyond what I even experienced.
Yeah, and we don't know if there were crimes committed in this house, but law enforcement authorities implied strongly that a quote-unquote mountain of evidence was found there. We'll get into that in a little bit. Elaine Halligrim says, you're making a big difference to the world, Carrie. Thank you for being so brave. We've got Tali watching us in Israel, staying up late. So appreciate that, Tali. We got the best audience, best crew, the best community in all of true crime. Mark Safarik, let's get some of the housekeeping details, if you will, out of the way, and then we'll get into the stuff that you guys are the best at. But he was in court on Tuesday. It was a hearing that lasted 32 minutes. No one from Heuermann's family, not surprisingly, showed up. And he was reported to have glared. The lawyer declared there would be no plea deal. And here's a direct quote. There is no plea deal. He said, meeting Rex Heuermann, from the moment that I met him, that I did not do this. Apparently, he also cried, according to other reports. So we are prepared to go forward. We will defend this case in a court of law, and we will go to trial in this case, said defense attorney Michael Brown. Your reaction to that, Mark, especially with your law enforcement background?
Well, I mean, that's what I would expect. I mean, that is his job. The reports about him glaring, I saw those photographs. I mean, I think he's just, he's just standing there, you know, looking rather glum, but I don't know if he was glaring or not. But, you know, this is the process. Of course, they're going to say that he didn't do it. But the physical evidence is very, very compelling. The direct evidence and the circumstantial evidence is very compelling. And as Laura pointed out, if you read the bail application, it's very detailed. Now, this application was only to prevent him from being released. But there's quite a bit of information in there. And, you know, at this point, this is what's going to happen. And this probably will, if there's a trial, if he doesn't, you know, if he doesn't come forward and confess, then probably a year plus. But the things I want to talk about really are, this is very typical of successful serial killers, is that this ability to compartmentalize different aspects of their lives. Dennis Rader he called it cubing, where he really talked about, you know, looking at the sides of a cube. So when he's the architect, he's showing you that side of the cube. You can't see the other sides of the cube. When Dennis was the Boy Scout leader, you'd see the Boy Scout side. Or when he was the church leader, he would put that side to you. You couldn't see the other sides. And I think that's a really good analogy because, you know, like the family member said, they had no idea. The neighbors had no idea, of course, because this, you have your public life, and then that's what you show to everybody. And that's what you show to work, coworkers and people on the street, neighbors. And then you have your private life, which is the life that you share with a few people. And then you have your secret life. And that secret life is only known to you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was very good, like other serial killers have been, which is what makes them successful, is this really this sort of face of normality, right? That they can appear on the surface to be like everybody else. They don't stand out. You know, they're very normal, and they essentially fly under the radar. And, you know, you look at him and his background and his life and where he lived and all of that, you know, really makes sense. And it's one of the reasons they become successful at being killers.
And Carrie, pop in, Carrie.
Yeah, on the cubing. So Dad, I call him Dad. I appreciate you calling him Dennis versus BTK. I appreciate that because, you know, I don't use BTK. But everybody in headlines always says BTK's daughter. And I'm like, oh, she's got a name, guys. Anyway, like he developed that with Dr. Ramslin. And you're spot on with what you're saying. The thing is, when I understood cubing a while ago, I assumed it was more a slower process. Like you said, okay, I'm over here and I'm scout leader, or over here I'm dad, and I'm slowly flipping that side. And he would do it down to what he was wearing, how he talked, how he moved. Now, say if he was talking to you, Mark, as an FBI agent, he would change his voice. You can see him in court when he's pleading. Like he's literally sounding like police. You know how you all sound? Like I don't sound like that. You all talk police. He can alter himself so it makes you more comfortable. So it's like a chameleon, sure, and a mimic to you. But where I thought this was a slow process of like him thinking, okay, I'm a Cub Scout leader or I'm dad. It's literally like a multi-sided dice and he's spinning it very quickly. And he's literally like the whole time he's spinning it and front facing, like here's private, here's secret, and BTK's right here. And if you know him well enough, you see BTK popping up all the time in these flashes. And like, I'm just now seeing that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, you say that in hindsight, but it's very difficult. You know, I mean, they're very good. They tend to be psychopaths, so they don't really have remorse for what they do. They manipulate and use people, even family members. I'm sure you experienced that. But they're very good at showing people what they want to see. And, you know, you're right. It's not just a cube. It's a multifaceted ability to whoever you're dealing with, you know, to show them, you know, that this is how I'm going to respond to you, whether it's law enforcement or, you know, or the neighbor next door. It's going to be a different response. But you don't get to see that private piece, that secret piece of him. of Rex, and even the family doesn't get to see it.
Yeah, but it comes out in flashes. So, like, right now, let's just establish, because Anne and Laura know me well. Like, well, I spent time with Laura talking last week, and then I've been working with Anne for months. Like, let's just establish that I was in a household full of abuse, multi-layers for decades, to levels I can't even talk about right now that I'm just finding out, like, in the last 2 months. And so, like, I had a conversation with Laura that the FBI didn't know these things. Like, I don't know who knew and what they knew and when. And sometime I'm going to have a private conversation with Quantico, basically. But the reality is, like, when I'm talking about that cube and those flashes, like, when he was coming at me to attack me when I was 16, that's when those masks drop. And that's where you catch that flash. Of course, in hindsight, now you're realizing, like, you still think that's the whole iceberg, right?
Yeah, what it is, right.
But when it's, but once you find out that that's just the tip. So yes, in hindsight, I'm going back and saying all these times that, like, that was coming out. But, like, the reality is that, like, I'm having a hard time because I'm learning new things about my dad this summer, and I'm processing all this. And now I'm being asked to come in and sit with you guys that have done, like, 30 years, decades of work. And, like, it's frustrating as his kid and as a female. Yeah. I mean, Lauren, you can chip in.
Yeah, this is heavy stuff. And Carrie, we obviously really appreciate you being here and sharing this, whatever you're comfortable sharing. Marina's watching us from the south of Spain. Kilo chiming in from Boston. Her withdrawals have subsided. Hey, Laura, you know, Carrie just mentioned something very difficult, which is abuse within the family. You're an expert in coercive control. If you could just explain to the layperson like myself, what is that? And do you think, and I know it would be kind of speculation on your part, but it would be educated speculation. Do you think Rex Huerman was abusing his own family in some way, the children or the wife?
Yes, well, I think firstly, what Carrie is saying is very important in that how we used to understand abuse. We go back in time and people would ask about physical abuse. Did he hit you or did he rape you? And they're not the questions to ask on their own of women and children. We should be asking about control-related behaviors and when you felt safe. Or did they make you feel unsafe? And controlling your space and your time and your feelings and your behavior. And what Kerry was describing was leakage from Dennis Rader of when he's in control, everything's hunky-dory, right? When he's got everybody and everything under his control, which is his best way of operating with all his notepads and all the things that he did, wearing his uniforms, which used to make him feel very powerful. But when Brian or Kerry or anyone in the house got out of control, as he would see it, he needed to use physical abuse to regain the control. So now we understand coercive control much better. And for anyone who's interested more in it, please do read Dr. Judith Herman's work on the subject about trauma and recovery. She was talking about coercive control in 1992, but I criminalized it in England and Wales and the UK in 2015, because it was the thing that victims talked to me the most about, would say things like the physical, the bones would mend and the bruises would fade, but the psychological terror and torment and emotional torture and constantly walking on eggshells and the game playing and this insidious behavior, you can't see it, you can't put bandages around it, but I'm having to live by these rules and regulations of somebody else. And if I don't do what they say, there's a consequence. And it can be very subtle and very nuanced. So really coercive control is about keeping people in control, but utter domination, being able to dominate them and use them to get your needs met. So someone like Dennis Rader, and I agree, I don't like these monikers that are used that make these individuals who want to be seen as bigger than and more powerful. We shouldn't be using these monikers that they want us to use. Also, when it describes what they did to their victims and it gratifies them, but it it creates such upset and stress for the family members that are left behind, including, and I include the family members of Dennis Rader as Kerry and Paula and Brian, and the same with Rex Heuermann's family, who are going through an absolutely horrific time. And they are victims too, and yet the media are hounding them, and almost as if Asa should be answering for his behavior, which makes me very angry, because women and children should not have to answer for an abusive man or a violent man's very worst acts and murderous behavior as if they're somehow culpable or responsible. But here we are all the time with the media chasing down, well, what did the wife know? Well, she must have known something. Well, what we do know is that she's been blindsided and that she used food stamps, for example. And he was an architect. He's got an office in Manhattan. And yet he's making money, but the childhood home is dilapidated. It's got a lean-to. It's got plies of wood holding up the porch. He's not putting any money into this home, but he's buying himself 297 guns and building a basement and a vault. And that's where he's putting his time and money and energy, not into his wife and not into the children. So economic abuse, well, that's a form of coercive control. So for me, there are hallmarks of it. And the fact that she was leaving town and he was offending, well, I would imagine that he tried to control her behavior, the time, space, what she did, how she did it, and economically as well. So I'm sure more will come out, but I do see her very much as a victim. And I really don't like the fact that she is the one that's being chased and harangued and harassed, much as Kerry and her family were poorly treated. And I really hope that the children don't have this horrific legacy of being called the daughter, you know, the daughter of, the son of, and using this horrible moniker as if that's what defines who they are. It's a horrible legacy that these men leave, not just in terms of their murderous acts to the victims, but for their own families, because many of them do get married. And that tells you about the height of their entitlement and their selfishness and their narcissism, that it's all about them.
I just had an outer body experience watching and listening, saying, wow, these guests are really amazing, and then realize it's our show. So it's amazing to hear these experts well put. And invariably, people like Kerry and Rex Heuermann's family, they will also be vilified, and they are the victims here as well. So we've got to keep that in mind. Kerry toes a fine line with that. Anne Burgess, to you, Edgar Allan Poe wrote a book called The Imp of the Perverse, kind of a perverse question, but are you born a great serial killer? I mean, Mark was talking about cubing, you know, Dennis Rader showing different faces at different times. That's a skill. It's a perverse skill. So are you born a great serial killer? Can you become a great serial killer over time? Is it something that you are just given as a trait, as when you come into the world?
Well, that's a question that has been looked at in research on the nature of the nurture dichotomy. And they've tried to look at it to try to see whether there's any genetic link or whatever. And they've really never been able to do that when they use control groups and so forth. But certainly I agree with you that they can become one. And the becoming is where we're really interested. We know at the 36 serial killers that we looked at down at Quantico, that there was a very early onset of a interest in murder, in fantasy, developing ideas and so forth. And that over time, by the time they reached adolescence, seemed to be when there was some acting out. So there would be, I would look at a timeline on this suspect from early childhood through up to adolescence, and then see in those adolescent years that something really started developing. Many times serial killers start raping, and seeing if they can get away with it. They often start even sometimes in the family or the neighborhood, and then move out to from known victims to unknown victims. The escalation issue is always very important to look at, because I don't think I've ever seen a case where they just all of a sudden start murdering, that there really is a progression, escalation, whatever you want to call it, moving up the line to greater and greater, because the the payoff for them starts to diminish. And so that's the need to kind of keep on committing crimes. And they can go from serial killing into dismemberment and all kinds of other things. So there's no end, if you will, to what they can do. That's why they really need to be caught. I think one of the research questions I've always had is to ask these killers, what could have happened to, why didn't they catch you earlier? If they had only caught you earlier, maybe you would be sitting on death row or wherever you are, and get that. And when you'd ask them, I can remember we did ask several of the serial killers, and they said there were clear times when the police should have caught them, and they didn't. So that's an area we really need to get into. I think the other, from what Laura has already said and Carrie, is what is it that we can learn from the families once this kind of settles down and they get over their absolute shock over this? Is there something that we can learn? That's something that Carrie can certainly help with, so that we start to build more resources that we have to catch them earlier. For him, I'm interested in a timeline, why there are these periods of time where they don't have anything on him. There should be. I know they're looking at it. I know that they will go back and see. But were there times when he wasn't committing a crime? I think Dennis Rader, that was true, but we're not ever totally sure. I'll let Carrie comment on that. So if that is so, what is it that's taking its place? And is it maybe they are being very abusive to their family? Like Laura has said, that could be. I know there's been some look at the wives or partners of serial killers to see if there's anything common that we can learn from that. So these are all things that I think can be looked at. I know that Mark has done some wonderful research of his own on elderly who have been, because that's a talk about a neglected group when they're raped and murdered. So he might want to add a little bit on that, what they've learned.
Yeah, Mark, I would love to get your take just on this notion of being born, you know, the title of the movie, and that naturally born killer. Are you born a serial killer and an effective one? Also, love for you to weigh in on the height and the size of Rex Huerman. And his, you know, in his ability to carry out and intimidate in these crimes, assuming he committed them.
Right. So I think Anne talked a bit about this issue, and it's a question that we get all the time. Is this a nature or nurture? And there's been a lot of research that's been done on this. There's a great book called The Biology of Violence by Deborah Niehoff that really addresses this issue. And I think what we've really come to understand is that it's a combination of nature and nurture and emotional stability, abuse. And it affects different people at different times in their lives. So it really is a process. And I think what I find interesting about Rex is that, you know, you look at the cases that they have against them. These are women that were located in 2010 and 2011, right? So that puts Rex at about 46 years old. That's really late for a serial killer. You know, that's a developed serial killer. We don't see them typically starting that late. And, you know, as Anne was mentioning, where we really see this development is in adolescence, where there's a fusion of violence and arousal and certain behaviors. And oftentimes they don't understand what that is, but they find that engaging in certain activities is arousing to them. We see this a lot in well-known serial killers, Bundy, Dahmer, Gacy, and others, their history when they were young, even Dennis Rader's early childhood history with interests in various, fetish aspects. So when that development comes around, there's a lot of fantasy that they're engaged in. And as they progress, we typically see when they're acting out oftentimes with willing partners or paid partners, but that is not enough after a while. And then they cross that line where they take a non-willing, non-compliant or non-willing individual and commit a homicide. And oftentimes we see that development really in early to mid-20s. So, you know, what is Rex doing, you know, in this 20-year interval? And is he active? Is this fantasy development? Is, as Anne says, is he progressing? We do see this progression from, you know, fetish burglaries where they're breaking into homes at night, they're creeping around, they're watching people, they're watching people while they're in their house, and that progresses, and, you know, to sexual assault, and then ultimately to, you know, they're not being satisfied enough, ultimately to homicide. So, I mean, it's very important in this investigation that they work backwards with Rex. Now, I think what's interesting is that, you know, his wife is out of town. See, because for a number of serial offenders and, you know, Green River Killer, Robert Lee Yates, the Spokane serial killer, you have to have that opportunity. And, you know, you can't just tell your family, oh, I'm predating, I'm going hunting, right? So you have to find opportunities to do that, to engage with these potential victims. And he used that opportunity when his wife wasn't at home. So, you know, what was going on, you know, 10 years earlier, 15 or 20 years earlier, I think these will be very interesting questions to address. And I think Laura is spot on this whole coercive control. And I noticed this I testified in the Spokane serial murder case, and you see the damage that's done to the families, and, you know, in the same type of thing that happened to Carrie is happened to them, the hounding by the media, you know, how could you not know, you know, he's been killing for 23 years. How could you not know? How did you not have an inkling of any of this? And it's really tragic because they're victims as well.
And I want to get to Laura in a moment about, you know, Mark just talked about possibly starting his killings at the age of 46. I want to take a look at that a little bit closer. Ketchup, who's a friend of the show, if you could speak, Carrie, to Rex's wife and children, what advice would you give them? Before you answer that, L.A. Not So Confidential, Mark Safrick is a fantastic person for a guest. Love his book about spree killers. Shout out to Dr. Shiloh there. But what advice would you give right now to Asa Ellerup and the two children, Carrie?
They need to be in trauma therapy. Like, I was just talking to Jim Griffin and Sarah Azari the other day, defense attorneys, and they said they would like to see me sort of build like a victim advocacy side on the side of criminal families. So, like, where you get victim services to the crime side, like, my family never had any victim services. It was one interview with the FBI, a couple phone calls, and then it was, see you later, have a nice life. No offense to the agents in this chat, but that is the reality. I don't know if it's gotten any better. Looking at that house, I have my doubts. So we're talking about maybe like a 5 or 10 year plan where I keep getting trained, I get educated, you know, and like I build victim advocacy. So really when the FBI agent stepped in my house, he needed to be trained. They sent an accountant to my house, right? They sent an accountant to my house. He stood in my kitchen and he dropped on me that dad was BTK. And I went into medical shock for 5 days. I needed to be taken to the hospital and knocked out. I have CPTSD because of how that was handled. Now that isn't anybody's fault. It's just the reality of the situation. And 10 years later, when I started speaking up, I said, where were they? Where have they been the last 10 years? And I was told, well, they just got to go catch the next one. And they got to go catch the next one. And they got to go catch the next one. And they caught him and they locked him away. And that was that. Right. And then I have a conversation. It's 20 years. It's 18 years later. And I have a conversation with Laura a week ago. And she's telling me the FBI told her in 2005, my family was not abused. And Laura's come up with this whole screener for the United Kingdom, she was telling me. So you need to pair up. He should have been brought in with a woman. He should have brought in with victim services. Okay? We can't go back to 2005, and we can't even go back to Rex's family 2 weeks ago. But for the next one coming, there needs to be victim services right at that moment. Somebody needs eyes on those people before they suicide themselves, right? And they need screened. Because if anybody had come back to talk to us after we were out of shock and trying to protect an alibi or dad, I literally turned him in on his eighth murder. Why didn't anybody come talk to me about that one? Right. And then nobody checked on us. I had PTSD. I was going insane for 2 years. And I drug myself back to therapy. Right. I'm here because of what I've done and the help I've got. Okay. I just got to like Anne 6 months ago and I found Laura. Right. So when you're talking about Herman's family now, somebody needs to get them into trauma therapy yesterday. Somebody needs to get them out of the house, needs to put them someplace safe. Someone needs to go in there, pick up all their stuff, get them out of there. It's a crime scene, right? That they trashed. So get them out of there, give them support. The city needs to buy the house like they did with my parents' house, level it, give them a new life and protect them. But I'm telling you, there's lawsuits coming. I expect your Asa and her kids, I expect them to be suing the DA and law enforcement. And I don't know where I feel about that because I try to walk all these lines and I'm pro-victim and I am pro-law enforcement, but I'm expecting this to get really nasty very quickly.
Yeah, and they have lawyered up and we will get to that. And again, kudos to Carrie for speaking out. I am no therapist, but the son of two and, you don't need a license in psychology to see the trauma that has been inflicted on, Rex Tierman's wife and children. You just have to look at their faces. Obviously, you can't forget about the victims and their families. And they were in court. And the devastation they're going through is unparalleled as well. So it's difficult because you've got a lot of victims on all sides of this. Just back to some housekeeping notes here about court yesterday. Laura alluded to this. Rex Tierman's lawyer was given at least 8 terabytes of material from the state, from Suffolk County. It's equivalent to about 2,500 pages of records, along with about 100 hours of surveillance video recorded outside of his home, as well as prior to his July 13th arrest. But the DA, a guy named Ray Tierney, says it's just a fraction of the evidence. They also agreed on a confidentiality agreement between prosecutors and Michael Brown, Rex Tierman's lawyer, that prohibits sharing copies of the evidence with the public. Laura, to you, the wording, the semantics of some of this is always curious to me. You hear some say that there are 11 victims found at Gilgo Beach. Others say more than 10 sets of victims. The sex workers were petite in size, greener hazel eyes, except with two exceptions, that of a toddler, a 2-year-old girl, and a young Asian man who was possibly transgender. And then you start to look at some of the details of these victims. Peaches, she was given this name because of a tattoo on her chest. She was discovered in 97, and then parts of her body, I guess, were uncovered, or the toddler's remains were uncovered later on. I guess it begs the question, when do you think these killings did begin, if you had to guesstimate or speculate here? And it's to Mark's point that he doesn't think or intimated that maybe it didn't start till he was 46 years old. Do you think it's possible this goes back much further than we know right now?
Well, I'm sure. And I think the point Mark was making is that serial killers don't start in their fourth decade of life. And I certainly don't know of any case where that has happened. So he would have been offending. And as Anne mentioned, the escalation, at what point did that happen? This is his childhood home. He has a strong connection there, obviously feels very comfortable there. And when you've got 10, 11 sets of bodies being found, well, that should be ringing huge alarm bells to law enforcement and to everyone locally. And the fact that four of them, and it's believed that Maureen Brainard Barnes, we're just awaiting, I would imagine, forensic tests to be resulted for that one to be linked and charged. You've got four women, young, petite females, a very clear victimology, but it doesn't always start out like that. and other people can be victimized by a serial killer. So I think, you know, of course, they're going to have to look in that particular locality, first of all, and think very carefully about which cases are linked. But there will be others, whether it's peeping, stalking. You know, stalking is a gateway crime that's often overlooked. And someone like Dennis Rader, Rex Heuermann, they will be thinking about this all the time. It's 24/7. There's no such thing as a part-time serial killer, even though they may compartmentalize, but they are thinking about this all the time, and their planning and their preparation. So I hope that they're thinking broader than murders. The stalking cases, indecent exposures, you know, the positive side is that he is very tall and very big, and I would imagine relatively easy to be identified in terms of live victims. So, of course, there are also the task force following up on all the bits of information and intelligence coming in from other women who have found themselves in a position with Rex Heuermann where he made them feel uncomfortable, or he creeped them out, or as prostitutes were asked to do certain things that and sadistic acts that they were very uncomfortable with. So this is a very vast investigation where they really do have their work cut out for them, because they have to go back to for me, prepubescent Rex Heuermann and what he was doing at that time, his family. You know, was he even peeping on if he had a sister? We know that with other serial killers, they start in the home, or they can do. And as Anne said, then their behavior goes outside the home. And this is where I really want law enforcement. A lot of my work is about education and intervention and prevention, to make the links and join cases up. And because somebody has murdered, it doesn't mean that they will continue to kill. They may indecently expose, they may stalk, they may rape. So that's why you, in terms of the modus operandi and his signature, it's actually much broader than targeting sex workers and prostitutes, who really are easy targets for him. In a sense, but I would imagine there were lots of other things too, and there's a lot of work to be done here for the task force in terms of his timeline.
Someone in the chat yelling at me that Ann Burgess is not speaking enough tonight, the legend. That's what happens when you got Mark Safarik and Laura Richards and Carry On with her, but we're going to get Ann in right now. Question from Janet. How likely is it that Rex would keep killing but find a different dumping ground? The Massapequa Preserve is nearby. But also, just to weigh in on this, Anne, about, you know, when do you think he started all this potentially?
I've been trying to do a little bit of math here. If he's 46 when he's caught, and he is married, what, when he's 28? From that would put him, because he's got a 24-year-old daughter. Well, I want also know what's under that country.
He's caught at 59. Oh. Caught at 59.
Oh, 59. Oh, okay. Well, we have to move it way back. What's under the concrete? What year was that done? When was that? I'm wondering if anybody is buried under that, because it's pretty hard to go through concrete. I don't know if they can use any kind of x-ray, whatever. But I would like to know that date. And then he puts his guns in there. So that becomes a very important room, whatever that was all about. I'd want to know a lot more information. And also, I think, as others have said, that we need to see, to watch the timeline. We know that the father died when he was around 11. Do I have that right? I'm trying to remember. So that was an important loss for him. Yeah. And you'd want to look at that, because then the mother, and he has a younger brother. So those would be some important milestones, if you will. And then he evidently, how's his schooling? There is some evidence that he's very large. He would probably possibly teased or something. They'll try to bring that in somehow. But his large size certainly is intimidating. And I think that's important to think of, how the victims were controlled, if you will. That one got away was amazing. However, evidently that didn't last too long. So the other dumping grounds, that's the question. And unless there's something very special about the beach, my hunch is he could have them other places. That it's only when they have, I think they talk about signature and signature ritualistic kinds of behavior has its roots in something psychological or emotional. So that is what you would look for. I think Mark can certainly speak to the signature aspects of crimes, as the agents did a lot of work on that. So those are some of the questions I would have. I think the question that was on there's a preserve right nearby in one of the towns, and whether that was a possible burial ground, if you will.
Mark, to you, you're a former police officer as well. This investigation, and I'm talking about at the home, specifically at the home, lasted nearly 2 weeks, which is a long time for law enforcement to be in there. Authorities revealed that there was a quote unquote massive amount of evidence found there. They're not going to go into details about it, which is no surprise. The DA was asked whether or not the search uncovered any trophies. There were some disturbances found in the ground. What do you make of the work police did at this home and the possibilities of what could have been found there and the treasure trove of material it could contain?
Well, you know, when you are conducting a search, you have control of the residence. And once you relinquish control, then you really can't go back. So you don't know what is evidence in this. And I agree with what Carrie is saying. Look, you've got to have someone who's going to handle the family, and you've got to explain to them what's going on. You've got to take care of them. But when you're in a house like this, you don't know what's evidence. So you're taking a lot of things. Some things you think are going to be evidence, you don't know. But you want to be able to take a lot of material. The search warrant probably allows for literally anything to be taken. You know, destroying the house is really unfortunate. And I know I listened to his wife said, and I think that's very sad that they really destroyed it. And, you know, this is where she lives. She doesn't have anything else. It's problematic. But, you know, they're going to be going through a lot of this evidence and testing it. So as to the issue of trophies or souvenirs, those are terms that we use within the behavioral unit. We make a distinction between trophies and souvenirs. I don't know if they found anything like that. I know some of the victims did not have items, their clothing with them. So it wouldn't surprise me if they did locate some things that would be considered trophies or souvenirs. Probably for a guy like this, he would have had it secreted some other place. I think going back to the point I made about 46 is that, you know, it would be very late to be starting. I mean, I just don't see, we don't see serial killers starting in their 40s. They're starting in their 20s and then they're escalating. You know, he gets to a point where he becomes comfortable in how he's going to handle himself, his demeanor, and the whole fantasy part, the developing, the planning, it's all very arousing to them. This is, they enjoy this, the weeks or months of planning and thinking about this and what they're going to do and what kind of person they're going to get and what they're going to do to them. This is all part of the arousal piece that excites them. You know, we look at the Gilgo 4, and they're very, they have a lot of common characteristics in terms of, you know, who they were, their age, what they look like, they were sex workers, how they were disposed of, very close to each other, which is a bit unusual, but bound up and in, you know, covered in burlap sacks or some type of camouflage sacks. So there is you know, as we look at, and Laura knows this, we, of course, we look at their modus operandi. That is the behavior that they engage in to be successful. What is it that helps them protect their identity and get away and be successful? Then we look at their ritualistic behavior. So that is need-driven behavior. That is emotionally and psychologically need-driven. And typically that kind of behavior elevates their risk at the crime scene. And then when you put those together, both in MO or in ritual, then we typically referred to as that as a signature, where you have those repetitive behaviors over and over again. So I think it's going to be so important to go back and develop a timeline for him from adolescence forward and look at all these different cases I'm not talking about murders. I'm talking about prowling, peeping, burglaries, those types of things in that area where he lived.
And Mark, one thing that struck me was obviously the petite size of these women that he targeted, but also it appears they all had hazel or blue eyes. Does it get as detailed as that? Do you see that with serial killers?
I mean, it could, serial killers generally have a victim type that they like, and that can develop over time. It might just be coincidence, that they have blue eyes. But, you know, he's searching them up on Tinder and, other forums, so he can see pictures of them and knows what they look like. So he's picking them based on, the various physical features and availability, being in the area. That could be one of them. I don't know that we can't say that now.
Yeah. And Mark, we're going to go a little while longer. I know you may have had a conflict. Love for you to stay on your call. So,
but okay, thank you.
Would love to keep you here. Laura, we know law enforcement has come out, said that no human remains were found in the quote unquote very cluttered one story property. And it was interesting what you said earlier, because he had, had a good job as an architect, but was kind of, I guess, not prioritizing financially his home. Maybe he was spending his money elsewhere on sex workers and other things. They're going to process now for blood, hair, fibers. They did say that there was a vault in the home big enough to walk into, and there were reports of a large mattress found in there. Police wouldn't confirm or deny the bit of information about the mattress. But what do you make of that? I mean, you don't hear about homes with vaults that you can walk into very often, especially not with mattresses. So is that potentially a massive piece of evidence that they came across there?
Well, I think they have to consider it to be, yes. And, very disturbing, this concealed room vault that could well be soundproof, I would imagine, given the concrete, et cetera. It just makes me think about other cases, and Mark and Anne will probably be familiar with them, but like Joseph Fritzl in Austria, he had a basement that his wife was completely unaware of. You've got Gary Heidnik, who also had a basement and kept women in it. Ariel Castro, Marc Dutroux in Belgium. There are a number of cases where...
In California.
Yeah, where men have successfully, created these rooms and put women in them. Was that what he was going to do next? Was that where he committed these crimes? Or was that because we know the type of fantasy, the sadistic nature of the behavior and needing to have time to want to spend time with the victims to carry out these horrific behaviors, these torturous behaviors? And it's a point that I did want to make, that people think serial killers, this is entertaining and fun. This is every person's worst nightmare. If you have been, brought to someone's house under a ruse and then you're taken to an underground room and there you remain being tortured for hours, days, weeks, months, with some of them, like Joseph Fritzl, he kept Elizabeth there for 24 years. And she had 7 children. There is nothing fun or exciting about this. It is just sadistic and horrific cruelty in terms of the behavior. So, yes, in terms of evidence, I agree with Mark. Going into a house, you don't really know what's evidence. The creepy doll, I would imagine that is that's evidence. They found a lot of things, but they're going to have to take lots of things and lay it all out probably in a huge warehouse, and it would take a very long time to process. But for someone like this individual, he likes to bide his time, and it's all part of the fantasy and control, doing things in a meticulous way, probably quite ritualistic, and a particular victim is chosen at a particular time for a particular reason, and it is just the stuff of nightmares.
And Mark, if you can, and I'm going to get to Anna in a second so I don't get yelled at anymore, but you pulled back the curtain here because they've got to now process for blood, hairs, fibers, other trace evidence. This is not the movies. What is actually going on right now in this part of the investigation? Now that they've gone through the home, they take out these evidence bags that we see. Are these being sent to the FBI crime lab because of the high profile nature of this case? And what is the actual process and the timeline to get the results back on all of these things?
Well, I think you have to evaluate the evidence and prioritize, you know, what are you going to be looking at? What are you going to be testing? What kind of tests are we going to be running on these various items? What are we looking for? So it's going to be, you're going to have other experts assisting the task force. And this is going to take a monumentally long period of time to analyze all of these pieces of evidence. I just want to say that, you know, when you think about, you know, and Laura touched on this, when you think about, you know, taking these women, right? So likely he's engaged them in some sexually sadistic behavior. You need a place to engage. So if you're meeting somebody somewhere, then you have to go somewhere. It's probably not in his truck, because that's too public. You have to have a place where, you know, you can engage and control them and do the things that you want to do. These women are all bound up. When they're found, they're bound up. So where is that taking place? You know, he meets them generally in the area where he was living. So does that mean he's bringing them home when his wife is out of town? Is that where he's engaging? I think that's the way the task force is looking at this. That's why they're taking so much evidence, because where can you find hair and fiber evidence, you know, in a home, literally anywhere? So it's a massive undertaking. And I think it's just going to take a long time, but you have to prioritize evidence. You can't run a test on everything. You're going to have to see what you think is going to be most important.
And that is why we have experts like Mark Saffer to explain it. Carrie, I promise we're getting back to you. But Anne, two interesting questions, one from Tali in Israel, who's a criminology student. I find it really weird that he had stopped the killing in 2010 from what we know, even though serial killers have a cooling period. But is it usual for a serial killer, or unusual, to stop all the way back then? And I'm interested in this question. Would love Anne's thoughts on why he lives in such a shabby house, and his childhood house at that. So, Anne, your thoughts?
Well, the childhood house, there's been some thought given that it's the father's house and he is honoring the father by not doing anything to it. But I think it's really rather unusual. He's an architect, and he certainly would have the skill to be able to design a house that he only adds on in this extra room, or he adds these little extra rooms rather than really remodeling. I think the kitchen was remodeled. I think I found that somewhere that is. But I would agree with her. It does live in a shabby house. The mother is still alive, as I understand it. She's in her 90s. So where is she? Has she been part of this? You know, what role did she play? I think is an important aspect to it. But the shabby house it certainly speaks to the way that he treated his family and his, because I agree with what there's money coming in somewhere and it's going out somewhere. So what does he have? Sometimes gambling is an issue. Was he spending so much money on other kinds of things? But I would hope they're going to get a forensic financial reading on his bank accounts to get some, and credit cards, to see if there's any answers there. So I don't think that, I think the first question was, is this unusual to have a length of time, a quote, cooling off period? That seems rather unusual, I would say. Usually they keep killing. They may take a little bit of time, but not the length of time. And we really don't even know when he started. And they have to, hopefully that's what they're working on now, is to get a good picture, if you will, of when all this started and some of the reasons why it started. Hopefully there was a first wife, and she might be someone to be able to give some information on. That would be certainly someone that should be talked to. And I think that the gender of people to talk would be good, that she certainly maybe have a female agent talk with her and see what which they can gather there, because it's very sketchy of what happens when that breaks up. There is a publication in the or published wedding report, and that seems to be it. So I think that's going to be very, very interesting. When does the second wife come into the picture? And I think she was raised, even though she was born in Iceland, I think she is grew up in the area that the high school, seems to me there is a high school there, but is there a big age difference? Does anybody know the age of Isa?
I don't off the top of my head. SGS Nation, let us know her age. I don't think it's a huge difference, though. Mark Safarik, to you, he's been described as a mama's boy, which doesn't bode well for me. Is that a common denominator amongst serial killers? Do you find a particularly close tie between a quote-unquote typical serial killer and their mother?
I think that there are so many misconceptions about serial killers that float around in the public venue. You have to look at every single case individually. Serial killers come in all cultures, all races. They come as males and females. You know, some are mama's boys, some are not. Some are very organized, sexually sadistic killers. Others are psychotic. We don't know enough about Rex, and I don't even know what that means. You know, when someone says he's a mama's boy, what's their interpretation of that? I just think, you know, serial killers are very different individuals. They all have very different aspects to their lives. And I think, you know, you have to look at each case, each individual separately, and, you know, figure out what type of individual that is. I don't like to make these broad generalizations about killers, because from my experience of looking at thousands of these types of cases, you have, you know, a very broad range of individuals. I did want to address, I think one of your listeners asked about this time period. A couple of years ago, I was a co-author on an article. We looked at sexual homicide, older sexual homicide offenders. And the vast majority, 90% of sexual homicide offenders are between the ages of 19 and 45. So we rarely see sexual homicide offenders over the age of 55. It's an incredibly small percentage out of, I think, 3,500 serial killings, sexual homicides that we looked at. It's well less than 1%. So as offenders, serial killers get older, and sexual homicide offenders get older, they become less active, and it's really diminishes over age 45. And by age 55, which was our cutoff, we only had maybe 30 out of 3,500. It's very small. So you can see why he may not be acting out as, you know, now he's 59. So he probably hasn't acted out for a while.
So they were hounding the media, that is, my former career. They were hounding Asa Ellerup, the wife. Finally, she spoke exclusively with the New York Post. As I mentioned, There's a son, developmentally disabled, Christopher Sheridan, 33, and 26-year-old daughter, Victoria Huerman. The lawyer for the family said they were literally, quote unquote, blindsided, caught by surprise. She has since filed for divorce. Ace Ellerip was, quote unquote, in complete shock, completely caught off guard. The two children are, quote unquote, crying themselves to sleep now, racked with anxiety after not only finding out the news, but 12 days ripping apart their Massapequa Park home. This brings us, of course, full circle back to Carrie, Ski Hat Sarah here. Carrie, are you doing okay with all this? I worry about you, followed by Carrie is wonderful, such a valuable resource of information. I don't know how she does it. I got to imagine, Carrie, every time a story like this breaks, not only does the media reach out, but, you know, others are asking you about it. So, I mean, you know, how do you cope, I guess?
Well, I guess even Laura texted me. She's like, are you okay? No, I mean, what's okay, right? Like, there's varying degrees of okay. I mean, there's been varying degrees of okay, like, the last 45 years of my life. I mean, I'm seeing in the chat, like, I'm going to get upset here, but, like, I'm seeing in the chat where people are like, they didn't know my dad abused me or abused my family. And Laura and I had a frank talk that the FBI didn't know that in 05. And I mean, at what point did the FBI know, or is it not in the textbooks, or is it not being taught? You know, one of the reasons that I speak up is because there aren't enough of me. I think there's maybe a handful of us kids. I can name one other right now, and she's the one that set up the GoFundMe for Ace's family, right? There's two of us in this. There's others, but, like, there's other kids out there, but most of us don't talk because of what we're put through, right? Like, we're coming out of these homes. We're damaged. We should be in a ditch dead. Somehow we're not. And, like, most of us never talk. And then when we do, like, we get crapped on. Not all the time, right? We find our corners. Like, this is a safe place. I have other safe places to talk. But, like, I literally see people in the chat. I've been talking for 8 years now, and they don't know that I've come out of multiple layers of abuse, and it's literally in my book. Now I'm even finding out it's worse than I know. And, like, we're not going to address that tonight, but I'll come back on sometime when I can. The reason I can't address it is Mark doesn't even know. There's active investigations going on in cold cases on my dad. And I can only talk about what's going on that's public in the news. It's been public in the news for 7 months. Okay. So when you got, I'm taking notes over here tonight. I'm over here typing. Like, I have notes from these three brilliant people, so I can keep learning. That's why I come on here. But, like, when we're talking about gaps, if you go read the textbooks on dad, we all thought he had gaps. We all thought he had these areas of gaps where he, like, he talks about a volcano and a triangle, right? And he draws them. He drew them for Ramsland. He had one for each of his 10 murders. And it's literally what everybody's talking about tonight. They're stalking. So he trolled for victims, just anybody. And then he would start narrowing down and he would give them project names. So he has over 200 project names in his digital files, at least. Then he would narrow down and target. And he didn't necessarily know anybody's name until they were murdered in the newspaper. So with my dad here, for the last 18 years, we took him at his word on that 30-hour confession that he only did the 10. Now there's cold cases being looked at actively by multiple agencies right now. And the reality is that, like, I'm involved in those. And so when I'm publicly on this show and I'm being asked only about Rex's family and I'm only being asked about 2005, my reality is 2023. Right? So I'm over here, I'm in trauma therapy right now, again, with a CCTP, dealing with what I'm finding out, trying to manage my life, dealing with PTSD. And then I've got a dozen national media outlets pinging my phone every day, literally the top tier people pinging me to come on and sit on their news desk and talk about 2005. And I'm in 2023. And then I'm gagged, literally almost, by what's going on in the Midwest. And like, we're like, frankly, where's the FBI? That's where I'm at this point. Like, because I'm literally actively investigating with people on these, and why is nobody asking me things?
Yeah.
So like, I'm trying over here really hard to keep it together on Joel's show. And everyone's over here like, hey, what's wrong with Carrie? Well, that's just a little bit of what's wrong with Carrie right now.
Well, we don't think anything's wrong with Carrie, but I know how you're feeling to some degree, very small degree. Chelsea Whitaker says, I wanted to tell Carrie, thank you. I'm 100% sure the GoFundMe set up for the family would not exist if not for you. You've taught people how to have compassion, empathy, such a much needed lesson. Laura, I always see this because Carrie's become a good friend and I have her on the show frequently. And then invariably you get people who say, oh, Carrie's just trying to profit and sell more books and this. And I know Carrie lives humbly. What do you, and you can see she's upset right now. What do you say to Carrie and what do you say to those people in response?
Well, I think Carrie's amazing. And having spent a lot of time talking to her, there's so much to learn from her lived experience and from her compassion and from her empathy. But also the FBI do need to talk with Carrie. And he was, you know, Dad was never properly timelined. And that's part of her frustration also in our conversation. And I must admit, I've kind of been toe-tapping when people keep talking about hiatuses because we don't know they're hiatuses. You know, if we don't ask the right questions of the right people, how will we ever know? And that's been, you know, Anne's work and my work and Mark's work of trying to build toolkits to help law enforcement ask the right questions. And one of the things I will say is that the families seem to keep being missed out. And it's a huge gap. We can learn so much from them. But my plea is also to ensure that whoever talks with the families, that they're trained in trauma and coercive control, that they ask the right questions. They understand what the codified answers mean. And codified answers are Kerry and others trying to see if we're safe people to tell, because there's lots of different types of people that work within law enforcement. And I mean, Mark will understand this, but a big burly 6'5", you know, officer with guns on his utility belt, et cetera, asking questions, well, did he sexually assault you? I've just got to ask that question, is not going to elicit the right answer from someone like Kerry. So we want to have every opportunity to help someone who's in trauma, but every opportunity to lay the table for success, i.e. we identify other cases and we help other victims get justice and their families. And I think someone like Dennis Rader is much more prolific and has been much more prolific. And I would imagine someone like Rex Heuermann, and in fact, every case that I've worked, they are much more prolific than we ever think that they are. And oftentimes, as Kerry mentioned, law enforcement may just move on or off, or maybe the right people just aren't asking the right questions. And I go back still now, I'm sure Mark does and Anne does, to cases that I've worked, and I still go back and ask questions of families that I work with. But I'm very interested in people's trauma, as is Anne, and also the intervention and prevention side. How do we, I think what we're all sharing in this particular panel, and thank you for bringing us on, Joel, is, you know, our desire to catch these individuals far earlier on to stop the trauma so that Kerry doesn't have to go through it and other families. And that's been my life's work at New Scotland Yard, running the homicide prevention unit, ensuring that we change laws as well to ensure coercive control and stalking are criminal offences, and we catch people far earlier in their offending career.
Yeah, you don't need to thank me. I need to thank you. Tilo in Boston, I saw her saying I was blacklisting her tonight. How dare you, Tilo? I was very glad to hear that the neighborhood is rallying around her and the kids. I bet that's going to help a lot, especially if she decides to stay there. I personally would not. I can't imagine that she could stay there. Loved when Carrie was on Laura's podcast. Such a great episode. The Crime Analyst on YouTube. Check it out. Couple other quick things I want to get to. Carrie, you know, I know you're kind of on again, off again in terms of speaking with your father, but how does he react to to these types of stories breaking in the news? Does he feel like a guy like Rex Heuermann has taken away some of his shine? What is his reaction?
You know, that's really the public perception, that like my dad wants to come out and make it about him. And we've seen it back and forth since 14 when I became in the media. And he had to be in the media. And then he was playing me for years against Dr. Catherine Ramsland, who he co-wrote a book with. He was positioning us against each other like chess pieces. I mean, he still can till to this day. On the flip side, if you do see what he said about, well, he said Rex was like a clone. I mean, they were both 59 when they were arrested. They both had wives, two children that were semi-grown. They both binded. I'm pretty sure Rex tortures. We don't know yet. They both strangled. Now we don't know if Rex dismembered. If he did, then that's a different kind of critter, a different level. Like Anne was saying, like, to me, it's like you go from more neat to chaotic in my mind. You don't go the other way around. And those are older. But then, Joe Jacalone was saying like, well, maybe he had met them different. So like Rex could have modernized his technique, or he didn't need to dismember them. But if you're going to give those to Rex, and that's different than my dad. But they both have the same drives as Mark and Anne and Laura talking about the sexual fetishes. You know, I this is going to sound inappropriate, but like there was no porn for my dad at the level he wanted it. So he made his own. Like he drew bondage and he recreated his own with my Polaroids. With victims' clothing, and you guys were talking about victims' clothing being gone. Like, did Rex store that? Did he use it? Did he try to wear it? Now we're asking, did Dad actually move victims' clothing around, put him on other victims? Like in these photos, you see where he's cut victims' clothing because to fit somebody as big as my dad or fit somebody like Rex. So what I'm saying is, when my dad is speaking up, yes, that narcissistic psychopath side wants the attention, but he does have things worth saying. Now, there's ethical issues. Should media listen to him? Should they give him a platform? My question is, did anybody in the last however many years they were looking for Long Island go in and talk to my dad? Now, can they trust to have a conversation with him? Is he going to be helpful? Is he going to run him around 500 times like he does? You know, it's not comfortable to go in and talk to him. Like, I get that side, but did anybody actually ask him? Because again, like Mark was saying, hindsight is like, we're over here in hindsight land, you can see them next to each other, but did anybody think to look at Dad and look at Rex, or did anybody come talk to me? No, of course not.
Mark, you care to respond to that?
Well, I think, you know, from my perspective that they're different. I know Dennis calls Rex a clone. I think superficially they are. But in terms of their processes, they're quite different, I think. You know, Dennis stalked his victims. He entered homes. He broke into homes. Rex is making contact with sex workers. Dennis didn't use sex workers. He found, as Carrie was saying, he would find women that met his criteria, stalk them for long periods of time, use ruses to get access to them. These are not things that Rex was doing. He was a totally different type of victim. I think Dennis did dump a couple of his victims, but, you know, Rex is not seeking media attention. Dennis was always interested in notoriety, sending letters and notes to the media and to the police, taunting them, educating the public about what he was and what he was doing. I didn't see any of that from Rex. I mean, he's really, as far as we know, never made contact except with one of the victims, I think it was Melissa, right? It wasn't Melissa's family that he made a couple of contacts, but no media contacts, no law enforcement contacts, not seeking that kind of notoriety, dumping his victims. That's not something that I mean, I just think there's a lot of differences, more important differences between Dennis and Rex than there's certainly, you know, the sort of the surface things that we see, age, children, married, you know, a job that, you know, seemed, you know, where people looked at him and said, yeah, he's, you know, he's a normal guy. But in terms of what he was, you know, and as Melissa said, or excuse me, as Carrie said, we don't know what Rex, you know, if in fact he's the guy, which I think he probably is, but we don't know what his motivation is. Is he on a mission? Is he, is it sexual? Is he angry? You know, those things, you know, we might find out later, but I think there's some significant differences between these two individuals. And you know, that this idea of going to interview serial killers to find out about other serial killers has not really been very productive in the past. It's been done a few times, but, you know, they see the world through their own eyes, through their own interests, through their own, you know, ritualized behavior. And it's very difficult, I think, for them to apply that to somebody else.
It's Melissa Barthelemy. Papa Bear. Yeah. Papa Bear here is watching us from Moscow, Idaho, a place that's near and dear to all our hearts. Obviously now infamous for the Idaho 4 killings. She says, we so admire Carrie, such ongoing courage. Like a shout out from Ireland. Show is the best I've watched in a long time because we've got the best guests. Best guests equals best shows. One more thing I just want to get Anne's take on, as well as Laura and Mark and, of course, Carrie. There was a former escort named Nicole Brass. She's 34 years old. She sat down with ABC Good Morning America. She said she went on a date and had dinner with Rex Huerman. And he, quote unquote, got off talking about the victims. He spouted information about some of the cases, saying things that were not widely known. She said she did it because she had to earn money for an opioid addiction. She spoke to the Daily News also. She came out and said that he was almost visualizing the murders. Quote, the quote is, when he spoke about the murders, it was almost like he was visualizing it in his head and getting off to what he was saying. Does any of this, Mark, if you want to weigh in first, don't go to Anne, but does any of this surprise you, Mark?
No. I mean, when I interviewed Joel Rifkin, it's the same type of thing. You can see it. It's like a videotape that they're watching in their head when he's talking about this. It's very arousing. You know, they can see this. It's very powerful. It provides a lot of control and power for them. And also because he knows, right? He controls that information that nobody else knows. So when he's putting this out there as sort of, you know, in the third person, you know, it's intoxicating for individuals like that to talk about those kinds of things. It makes them feel very powerful and in control. So it makes complete sense what she was saying.
And she went on to say that he had a smile on his face and, quote unquote, glossed over look in his eye when talking about the Gilgo Beach killings, which left her with a, quote unquote, really, really bad feeling. Again, same question I just posed to Mark. Does it surprise you to hear her take on a date she had with this guy?
No, doesn't surprise me. She's just lucky that she just had a date with him, because he could have flipped at that time and she could have been the next victim. So I think that it's always important to try to get someone that has escaped, or maybe not know that they have escaped, any kind of content that you can. And I think, as Mark said, that they're right in it. They're right at that time as they're talking about it. And they want to spend a lot of time doing that. There's not much else they think about. And I think that's important for people to understand that that's what goes on in the minds of a killer. How many other women escaped? It would be good to know. If more would come forward, that would be helpful. But he certainly did target his the vulnerable group, which is the escort. in the online, and it's another new, not necessary, well, new back then, it would have been new that that would be the way that he was accessing his victims by these burner phones. Now it's probably not as new, but because we've seen some other cases, but certainly the other area to keep looking at is social media. We're trying to encourage people to look there to see if you can see before they do something that there are any warning signs, red flags, whatever you want to call them, so that we can prevent as much as we possibly can more victims.
Well said. Laura, final word before we all get our final thoughts. This same person who came forward, just want to get her name right, Nicole Brass, 34. She said that, quote unquote, my gut was telling me I had to get away from Rex Huerman. He had asked her on a first date if she was a true crime fan. You're an expert in coercive control. How important is it to listen to your gut instinct when you're with someone who might be creeping you out? Before you answer that, Fran here says, the crime analyst, a hidden secret. Thanks so much for discovering her. Awesome show tonight. I hope she comes back often on the show. But how important is it to listen to that gut instinct when you're a female faced with a potentially creepy male?
Always trust your instincts. Always, always. That's what advice I give to everybody. It's how I close Crime Analyst, the podcast, and my YouTube channel. It's so important. We read so many things about people, not just with our eyes, but with every sense. So if you feel unsafe, get the hell out of there. And women, lots of women are experts at de-escalating behavior because we've had to do it so many times throughout our life. And just to go back to the comment regarding him behaving like that to her and asking about true crime, well, that tells you that he followed true crime and did have an interest. We know that through his internet searches. We know that he followed podcasts about him, that he followed the task force. And him asking her those questions, for me, it's all about power and control, his behavior, the fantasy, but he loves to feel that power and control. That's what's motivating his behavior. He has to feel more than, because probably inside he feels less than.
Listen, I could not have asked for a better panel. Mark Safrick, he was one of the most respected members of the FBI's Elite Behavioral Analysis Unit. He spent over 30 years in law enforcement, 23 years with the FBI, and half that time as a criminal profiler. Mark, I'm proud to say that we had over a million viewers last month. So I'd love to plug anything. If you have a book or a podcast, please plug away. And your final thoughts.
I'll just say I wrote a book with Catherine Ramslin. Catherine's a very good friend of mine. Yeah, we wrote a book on spree killers that came out a couple of years ago. So it's one of the preeminent books on really looking at categorizing spree killers and like in these types of cases, trying to find a way for law enforcement to be proactive. I think this is going to be a very long journey.
Mark, real quick, what's the title of the book and where can we get it?
You can get it on Amazon or, you know, really any of the book sites. It's called Spree Killers, Practical Applications for Law Enforcement and Criminology. I would say that we are in this for the long haul, and the task force, I think, has done a very exceptional job so far. So it's just going to take time to get through all of this evidence and develop a timeline. So, I mean, I don't see a trial for Rex until maybe the end of 24. I think we just have to be patient, but I think we'll uncover a lot of things as time goes by.
Carrie Rawson, always great to have you on. For those who don't know, she is an awesome person. Talk to her all the time. She's written the best-selling book, A Serial Killer's Daughter. She is Dennis Rader's daughter and a powerful voice. Carrie, your final thoughts tonight.
I see a lot of people tell me to take care of myself. I blocked out to media for the next week. Joel isn't the media that I blacked out to. Like, Joel is new media and safe. So I literally did, folks, I did pin a note on Twitter that says I am not available on Twitter. So if you ping me, tag me, DM me, I'm not there right now, guys. That literally is me taking care of myself, which I did last night. So if you all want me to take care of myself, don't ding me so much in everything. I promise I am working my butt off literally from sun up to sundown on so many things that most people have no idea that I'm doing. And I will eventually get some rest here at some point. I guess my thoughts is just be patient. Like Mark was saying, like, be patient with this investigation. We don't know what's coming out. I mean, we don't even have the fourth woman. You know, he's not even arrested on that one or charged. So they have so much work to do here, and they got so much discovery over, like he said, this is going to be a very long process for the family, for the crime victim families, law enforcement, task force, media. We're in for the long haul. And I want to say that, like, Mac McCollum, she's a mentor of mine. She pointed out today, like, everybody is traumatized here. Everybody is victimized by one person, Rex, okay? He's the one that caused all of this, right? So law enforcement's traumatized, medical examiners, forensics, you know, everybody is. It's varying degrees in, like, we try not to victim compare, but I'm saying, like, everybody's life, like, you're talking about investigators that have put how many years into this work, right? Like, some of them times it's their whole career. And so everybody's impacted here, right? And it's all back because of one, what I call a critter, making the worst choices he can. And it is a choice. They do have control over it. If they didn't have control over it, they would have been caught a long time ago. My dad has control. Rex has control. They're choosing. Every time they're doing it, they're doing it anyway.
Well put. Looks like Ann Burgess's It happened at the right time, but it looks like we just lost her. I've talked to her grandson. We've got to get her a better Wi-Fi connection, but we'll say goodbye here to Laura Richards. I'm so glad we had her on tonight. She spent time at New Scotland Yard. She was trained by world leaders at the BAU, which is where Mark Saffrick comes from. She's an expert in coercive control, host of The Crime Analyst. There's this question here: from all the study and research, and Mark could probably address this too, what proactive actions can be implemented to identify and intervene before people are murdered? Laura, is that something that you're able to answer?
Yes, well, I created a tool called the DASH, the Domestic Abuse and Stalking and Harassment and Honour-Based Violence Risk Model in the UK that all law enforcement use there, and other partner agencies like health, housing, all other organisations. And it's to ask victims proactive questions about, say, coercive control and domestic abuse and stalking, so that we pick up dangerous abusers that could well be escalating their behavior. And in fact, at New Scotland Yard, when we first trialed it, well, we were using it across a 13-year period, and we prevented 58% of domestic violence murders. And I think that was at the time where I first met Mark, actually, at the FBI. We were doing that work. 58% of our domestic violence murders, that's 33 people less dead every year. So understanding the warning signs, understanding the questions we should be asking children and adults where there is an abuser in a household, but particularly around coercive control, because it does correlate significantly with femicide, familicide, and suicide. So ask the right questions about that, and we will be preventing a lot of perpetrators from escalating their behavior.
And Laura's YouTube channel is The Crime Analyst. Lorna McKenzie letting us know Rex's first wife left him because he was abusive, had affairs, and was into porn. And this sums it up best. Lisa Galindo, the panel is brilliant. This panel is brilliant. Thank you. Thank you, obviously, to Dr. Ann Burgess, the legend who kind of forged the path for a lot of these other people like Laura and Mark. Want to say it's great to be back. We're going to do a show about the trip that I went to see my mother and her story about World War II. And I'll let you know when we're going to do that. Mark Saffrick, on the record, will you come back and join us again?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Bright case. You bet.
Yeah. Awesome. And Laura, hope you'll come back as well.
Absolutely. Sounds good.
Carrie, whenever you're ready. Until then, love you, America. And thanks for being here. Till next time. Tomorrow night, we're back 7 p.m. Eastern. We're going to dig further into the investigation into this case. And then Friday, 5 p.m. Eastern, we're back with Detective Phil Waters and Scott Duffy. We're going to hit this once again and then bring you a whole new set of shows next week. Until next time, love you all.